For this Thursday, July 16th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. The U.S. has now seen more than 3.5 million cases of coronavirus. And late today, the NCAA warning that there might not be fall sports if the data does not turn around from the wrong direction as coronavirus infections continues to increase across the country. A number of states now putting mask requirements in place. Montana, Arkansas, and Colorado joining the list. And more companies now requiring face coverings. Target and the drugstore chain CVS making the announcement today. They follow Walmart, Kroger, and Kohl's. But some governors, including Brian Kemp of Georgia and Ron DeSantis of Florida, resisting calls to require those masks. Pennsylvania is imposing new limits on indoor dining and the size of gatherings, with an uptick in that state. And the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, is threatening another economic shutdown if residents there do not comply with health guidelines. Also today, in a scathing op-ed, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan goes directly after the president in his response to this pandemic. He wrote in the Washington Post, quote, "We expected something more than constant heckling from the man who was supposed to be our leader." We'll also have the latest on how Twitter was hacked and more changes for the Republican convention in Jacksonville, Florida next month. The story shaping Washington today. It's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin on Capitol Hill, where House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says another coronavirus relief bill will cost at least $1.3 trillion. Making the argument that that amount may not even be enough as the disease continues to spike in a number of parts of the country. The House and Senate scheduled to return next week, and the $600 per week enhanced unemployment benefit will end at the end of this month unless lawmakers extend it. Congressional Democrats and Republicans still need to resolve a number of key issues, including any further federal help for schools trying to reopen safely, as well as demands from state and local governments hit hard with budget cuts. All of this comes as the speaker again criticizing the president for his response to this pandemic.
The president has made so many bad executive decisions. We wish he would make a good executive decision and do that. Observing his behavior, I have concluded that he is like the man who refuses to ask for directions. All of the answers are there. The scientists have the answers. We know that testing, tracing, treating, distancing, masking, sanitation can stop the spread of this virus. And yet the president continues to go down the wrong path and refuses to ask for directions from scientists who know better than any of us.
That statement earlier today by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi during her weekly Thursday news conference. By the way, Senate Republicans will be unveiling their coronavirus relief plans next week. GOP leader Mitch McConnell saying the focus will be on schools, jobs, and health care. Democrats want that, but they also want more aid for state and local governments, relief for homeowners, and extended unemployment benefits. On that front, more with Speaker Pelosi.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any contact with anyone in the administration over this next package, coronavirus package?
Everything in this package, except for, like, say, 95% of what is in this package, is what we have had in previous bills. So nobody is being asked to vote for something they haven't voted for before. The one thing that is different is they have resisted in the past any strong OSHA standard. And that is absolutely essential for us to have to protect our workers at all times, but an intense, even stronger one at the time of coronavirus. So they know what they have to do. There is another piece that they have resisted that is very urgent now. They resisted in the CARES and but very urgent now, and that is the assistance for renters. The moratorium is going to end, has ended in some places, and we really need to get that assistance. And that not only do we have it in the HEROES Act, but a couple of weeks ago, we passed it on the floor of the House as a separate bill, $200 billion, $100 billion to help with renters, $75 billion in addressing the mortgage forbearance, foreclosure forbearance issue, and then the rest of it for homelessness and special rural housing programs and the rest. They really have to do this. This is very, very urgent. Now, that would be something they haven't voted for before, haven't supported before, as well as they haven't supported a strong worker protection OSHA standard. But other than that, they've supported state and local government. They've supported testing. They've supported direct payments. They've supported unemployment benefits. One time they even supported food stamps. They've resisted since then, even though people who've never been to a food line before, a food bank before, are in long lines to get in. You would think they'd have some sensitivity on emergency food initiatives, including SNAP, the food bank. So that would be one where they have resisted, but they have voted for it before.
And, of course, the negotiations continue. Look for a lot of action next week when the House and Senate convene. The House, by the way, gaveling on Monday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Live coverage on C-SPAN television. So where is the Trump administration on some of these objectives, including further extension of unemployment benefits? The president's senior economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, spoke to reporters earlier today at the White House.
What's your message to Americans who are on track to lose their unemployment benefits this summer?
Why do you say they're going to lose their unemployment benefits?
Well, in the event that there isn't another stimulus, or depending on how the...
We're not going to take away unemployment benefits. I think what we'll do is put a more prudent cap on them at perhaps 70-75% wage. So we create incentives to work, not disincentives. And we're also looking at a reemployment bonus of some kind. Again, this is pre-decisional. I don't want to front run the president, but those are things we're discussing. We're not going to end unemployment benefits, certainly not. We'll probably have a targeted volume of checks, IRS checks, and the president is very, very keen, as I am, on a payroll tax holiday, which will increase after-tax wages. So we have quite a lot involved there. But we are not ending unemployment benefits.
That from Larry Kudlow, one of the president's top economic advisors. Meanwhile, the U.S., Great Britain, and Canada alleging that Russia is attempting to steal information about a coronavirus vaccine from researchers and organizations through cyber attacks. The focus of the investigation, jointly by the three countries, is a hacking group known as APT-29, often referred to as, quote, Cozy Bear, which is largely believed to be an operation as part of Russia's security services. Here in this country, the National Security Council is looking into some of the alleged techniques, including spear phishing and custom malware, to obtain that information. The debate over how and when to send students back to school continues to be a looming issue this summer for parents and educators. We learned today that D.C. public schools will be offering families the option for students to take all classes virtually this fall, or they can split their time between in-person and remote learning. Louis Farabee is the chancellor for D.C. public schools.
To do that, we are offering choice. And one of the elements that was reflected in the data as well is to ensure that families who want to have in-person instruction have the ability to choose a hybrid model, and then also the ability to offer a virtual-only instructional model for those students who have experienced success in a virtual-only option and would like to continue that for the 2021 school year. So what I'll do next is I'll walk you through what that will look like for all of our grade levels as we have prioritized learning at home for all of our students who need that, but also to maximize instruction in person with a particular leaning towards our earliest learners. We're also prioritizing students that may have special needs, students that may have individualized educational plans, or other unique services that may need to be provided in person that cannot occur in a learning at home posture. So for our earliest learners, students that are pre-K 3 and pre-K 4, they will be providing an opportunity to have cohorting in two ways. There will be a group that will be on Monday and Tuesday, and then there will be another group on Thursday and Friday, which will be our B group. Threaded throughout all of our models, Wednesday will be a virtual day and will also be a day that we'll have deep cleaning in our buildings.
Louis Farabee is the chancellor for Washington, D.C. Public Schools. Now, that plan for D.C. students similar to the proposal in place for Fairfax County in Northern Virginia. That, by the way, is the 10th largest school district in the country. We'll be talking to the Fairfax School Superintendent, Dr. Scott Brabrand, tomorrow afternoon. You can listen to the interview here on C-SPAN Radio at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time or on our podcast, The Weekly. Other school districts in the D.C. area, such as Prince William County in Virginia and Prince George's County in Maryland. The school year will begin with remote virtual learning only. That is also the case in a number of other large school districts, including Houston, Los Angeles, San Diego, and San Francisco. In what is being described as a scathing op-ed in today's Washington Post, this is the headline, quote, "Fighting Alone. I'm a GOP governor. Why didn't Trump help my state with coronavirus testing?" This from Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. He wrote in part the following. "I'd watched as the president downplayed the outbreak's severity and as the White House failed to issue public warnings, draw up a 50-state strategy, or dispatch medical gear or life-saving ventilators from the national stockpile to American hospitals." Governor Hogan goes on to write, "Eventually, it was clear that waiting around for the president to run the nation's response was hopeless. If we delayed any longer, we'd be condemning more of our citizens to suffering and death. So every governor went their own way, which is how the United States ended up with such a patchwork response. I did the best I could for Maryland." Now, in the op-ed, Governor Hogan explains in detail how, in part through his wife, who was originally from South Korea, he was able to get testing kits to Maryland from that country. And earlier today, Governor Hogan was asked about this during an interview on MSNBC.
Tell me what led you to this very strong denunciation of the White House response.
Well, just article that appeared in the Washington Post today was really an excerpt from the book. So it wasn't a current account. It was really a recollection from the first several months of this pandemic, going back to my accounts from February, March, and April, maybe early May during this pandemic. And I was just trying to be as honest and direct as possible. I've tried my best not to simply be one of the many people who've just been out there criticizing the president. I've tried to work in a constructive way. And I think they've made some improvements since then, quite frankly. But early on in the crisis, there's no question that there were serious mistakes that were made and that we could have done things better. And I speak very frankly about that in my book.
But with all due respect, this is still the case. The big story on the front page of The Washington Post today is that there is no plan. There's no plan for national testing. The president just in the last 24 hours talked to Dr. Fauci for the first time in 2 months. The CDC has been eliminated from gathering daily hospital data, and it's now been transferred to the Department of Health and Human Services, to the criticism of most public health experts. What has improved?
Well, I think those are some of the biggest mistakes that that the president made throughout this pandemic, and that was not following the advice of the experts, the doctors, the scientists, his own CDC, and people like Dr. Fauci, who, in my opinion, has been the most respected, most trusted voice, and the guy that we're getting the most honest information from throughout this entire crisis. And quite frankly, this recent attack, this campaign against Dr. Fauci, in my opinion, is probably, although it was not covered in my book because it's happened so recently, I think it's probably one of the biggest mistakes that they've made, because throughout this, I think many Americans, myself included, have been listening very carefully to the advice and the input and the wisdom of Dr. Fauci, and to exclude him and some of the advice from the president's own team, I think, is a mistake. And I talk about this in the book. I mean, there were really smart people in the administration, in the CDC and HHS, and folks like Dr. Fauci, who really were on top of this and who were giving great advice. And I talk about how the vice president was actually doing a good job of leading the coronavirus task force. But I think, you know, sometimes the president was ignoring the advice of his own people, and he was going in a completely opposite direction, saying an exact opposite message of what the entire rest of the administration was saying.
That from Maryland Governor Larry Hogan on MSNBC earlier today with host Andrea Mitchell. And in the Washington Post op-ed, part of the book, Governor Hogan said, quote, "We expected more than constant heckling from the man who was supposed to be our leader." Reaction from the White House: Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany was asked about Governor Hogan's criticism of the president.
Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said today that President Trump has left states to fend for themselves during this pandemic. He accused the president of not listening to medical experts. That is quite a takedown coming from a Republican governor.
Yeah, it's really striking on his comments, especially when you compare them to his past comments. This is revisionist history by Governor Hogan, and it stands in stark contrast to what he said on March 19th, where he praised the great communication that the president has had with governors. On March 19th, he also said, thank you, there's been tremendous cooperation. And what is so striking to me about reading that op-ed is Governor Hogan begins with this dramatic April 18th scene where South Korea delivered tests. But just the day prior, he said something entirely different. He, in fact, thanked the president for the progress we've seen in federal and state coordination in recent weeks and went on to praise testing capabilities. He said, with regard to some of the top needs of states, including ventilators and testing capabilities. So 24 hours before this dramatic opening scene of his op-ed, he literally was praising the president of the United States for delivering on testing.
And that pushback from the White House and Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany on Governor Larry Hogan, his new book and the op-ed in today's Washington Post. The Supreme Court today lets stand a lower court ruling that could potentially strip voting eligibility for up to 1 million Florida felons who have completed their sentences but have yet to pay outstanding fines or restitution. It was an unsigned opinion, the court declining to revisit a federal appeals court ruling that permits Florida to stop felons with outstanding court-imposed debt from registering to vote. Three of the court's more liberal justices, Sonia Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Elena Kagan, dissenting. Justice Sotomayor writing the following, quote, "Under this scheme, nearly a million otherwise eligible citizens cannot vote unless they pay money," calling the policy, quote, "a voter paywall." The dispute, though, concerns a 2018 amendment to Florida's Constitution that restored voting rights to those with felony convictions who had completed, quote, all terms of their sentences. That amendment making it clear that all court-imposed costs must be paid in full before any individual is eligible to cast a ballot. NBC News is reporting that following his testimony in the president's impeachment investigation earlier this year, the National Security Council sent a list of allegations about Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman to the Pentagon. The story pointing to sources who indicated the clear objective was to stop his promotion to that of colonel. Earlier this month, the Army veteran announcing he will be stepping down at the end of this month. More from NBC News White House correspondent Carol Lee.
Well, what we learned is that in late 2019, the National Security Council, where Lieutenant Colonel Vindman worked, sent a document over to the Pentagon, essentially listing a series of allegations against him that all related to the idea that he had created a hostile work environment while he was at the NSC. The memo or document was sent to the Executive Secretary of the Defense Department. The Pentagon then conducted an investigation into the allegations and could not find anything to substantiate them. But if they had, and this memo or document was sent right after Vindman had testified in impeachment, if they had found any validity to the allegations, he would have not been able to be promoted. And this was all happening in the context of his promotion potentially moving forward. So what it appears is that they tried to intervene in some way to stop this. And we know that obviously President Trump was unhappy with Vindman's testimony before the House in impeachment.
The president very public in his frustration and anger at the lieutenant colonel. But do we know who inside the White House was behind this effort?
Well, we know that the memo came from the National Security Council, and it included an allegation that the Lieutenant Colonel Vindman had verbally assaulted a colleague, and that when that was looked into, and both the colleague and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman were interviewed and as part of this investigation, when they couldn't find, they basically found that it was a typical kind of office spat. I mean, we don't know exactly who was behind this. I think the people we talked to for the story, essentially the belief was that this was were individuals who were kind of doing this on behalf of, not saying that the president was aware of this, but on behalf of what they already knew was his anger about this, and to try to essentially block him from being promoted.
And of course, this is now a moot point because Lieutenant Colonel Vindman announcing that he is retiring from the Army, but doing so reluctantly, calling the president in his announcement a bully in all of this. Any reaction from either the Lieutenant Colonel or his spokesperson?
They declined to comment for this story, but we know that from from Vindman's lawyer's statement that they feel like he was under siege and that he had no choice. I mean, the sort of journey of his promotion was that the Army approved it earlier this year. It was supposed to go into effect basically now, and there's a list that gets sent over, gets cleared through various channels. It went to the Defense Secretary, and it was supposed to be made public in mid-May. That's been held up, and according to people we talked to, it was held up because they were concerned that once it got over to the White House, which was the next step, the president would essentially line item veto his name, and he would not be promoted, and then that would put them in the position of having not gone through with a promotion that the Army obviously had approved. And so when it became clear that there was a delay and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was weighing kind of how to hit what next step to take, he made the decision to retire. And the Army, interestingly, granted that request rather quickly. He's now going to retire July 31st, which is pretty soon.
More details at NBCNews.com. Joining us on the phone, White House correspondent Carol Lee. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
On this Thursday, July 16th, welcome back. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio and as a podcast. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your other headlines. In a statement, Simon & Schuster CEO is calling it, quote, huge. Mary Trump's book on her uncle, the president, and the Trump family, selling more than 950,000 copies in its first day of release on Tuesday. And the New York Times is reporting that Rupert Murdoch's son and his wife donating more than $1.2 million to the fund supporting Joe Biden's presidential campaign. The Murdochs, of course, own Fox News, which includes some of President Trump's favorite programs, including Fox and Friends and Sean Hannity. At the White House today, the president holding a South Lawn event to tout his administration's efforts on deregulation. Just yesterday, we carried it live here on C-SPAN. He unveiled a series of rollbacks to the environmental review process for large-scale infrastructure projects, a plan expected to speed up those construction efforts. More with the president.
What we have achieved together is truly without precedent. Never happened before. The previous administration added over 16,000 pages of heavy-handed regulations to the Federal Register. That's why nothing got done. Under my administration, we have removed nearly 25,000 pages of job-destroying regulations, more than any other president by far in the history of our country, whether it was 4 years, 8 years, or in one case, more than 8 years. The prior administration piled up more than 600 major new regulations, a cruel and punishing regulatory burden that cost the average American an additional $2,300 per year. Think of that. The average American, $2,300 regulation, hitting low-income Americans by far the hardest. These regulations also inflicted a steep economic toll on African-American communities. By contrast, our reforms are putting more money into the pockets of hardworking Americans. In addition to saving every family more than $3,000 per year, My administration has just issued another reform that my council of economic advisors estimates will lower the price of new vehicles by more than $2,200 per vehicle. And I think we're going to get that up to $3,500 per vehicle. It's very exciting. And by the way, the vehicles will be better, they'll be stronger, and they'll be safer. Our regulation cuts are also delivering massive savings on broadband internet services, and some home energy bills will be really historically cut. It's actually amazing. As well as historically low gasoline prices. Gasoline prices, you look today, I think it was $1.99. At the same time, we saved our oil companies. We're now the largest, since we've been here, the largest energy source in the world. Nobody's even close, so it's great. But we saved them. They had a hard time a number of months ago, and frankly, for a long time, but we've saved them. But $1.99, they were telling me, in some cases lower than that. We're bringing back consumer choice and home appliances so that you can buy washers and dryers, shower heads and faucets. So shower heads, you take a shower, the water doesn't come out. You want to wash your hands, the water doesn't come out. So what do? You just stand there longer or you take a shower longer? Because my hair, I don't know about you, but it has to be perfect. Perfect.
And that from the president earlier today, the event on the South Lawn, the full event on our website at cspan.org, and reacting to his comments on deregulation today and yesterday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
The president today is going to be talking about how his administration has been rolling back regulation over the past 4 years and helping Americans rise out of poverty. He's doing that from the White House today. Today, the president is supposed to be talking about his administration rolling back regulation and helping Americans rise out of poverty.
Okay. I don't know what he's doing, but I want to tell you something. What he did this week in terms of NEPA and what Richard Nixon put in place to protect our environment and therefore the good health of the American people. Oh, some of the, shall we say, polluters were saluting it. But it was the wrong thing to do. So I don't know what specific danger to the environment or the health and well-being of America's families and workers he's considering today. But if it's anything like what he has been doing, that's most unfortunate. But I'll tell you this. He's done a lot of bad things. But nobody, you can't tell whether it's methane or mercury or what he's doing to the environment once or twice a week. Terrible things that have an impact on the health and well-being of the American people, the air our children breathe, the water they drink. But what does he do but say, I got beans on my desk, and that's what people cover, instead of the danger that he is proposing to our country and his administration. He has the henchmen of the polluters in his cabinet, always has, and he's implementing an agenda that he's going to rise up people from poverty by making them breathe foul air. I don't get it.
That from Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Now to that Twitter hack that led to the accounts of a former president, Barack Obama, of Democratic candidate Joe Biden, a number of celebrities, as well as some high-profile Silicon Valley companies. It is being called one of the worst cybersecurity disasters ever to hit a social media company. Fox News is also reporting that Donald Trump Jr. and Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio had also been locked out of their Twitter accounts following this widespread hack. At the White House today, Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany was asked about the president's account at Real Donald Trump.
Does the White House have a reaction to the hacking of Twitter last night? And do you have any broader concerns, or does the president have any broader concerns about using that platform to issue not only his own opinions, but official policy pronouncements, given its apparent vulnerability to hacking?
Yeah, so I spoke with Dan Scavino before coming out here. My team did, and Dan has been, and his team in digital, have been in constant contact with Twitter over the last 18 hours to keep Twitter secure, the president's Twitter feed. The president will remain on Twitter, but his account was secure and not jeopardized during these attacks.
And that's from the White House press secretary. Well, the Twitter CEO writing the following quote, Tough day for us at Twitter. We all feel terrible that this happened. We're diagnosing and we'll share everything that we can when we have a more complete understanding of exactly what happened. So more on this developing story, CNN.com writing the following, quote, while the scope of the incident was massive in its own right, it could merely be the tip of a very large iceberg with vast security implications. Cybersecurity experts and policymakers now worry that the Bitcoin scam may mask a much more troubling data breach involving personal communications of the world's most powerful people. And Business Insider writing, quote, the unprecedented Twitter hack of Elon Musk and many others may be part of a larger, more ominous attack. And Vice.com is reporting that Twitter employees may have helped the hackers to hijack the accounts. For more on that part of the story, we talked to Joseph Cox. He's a senior staff writer for the website Motherboard, which is part of Vice.com.
So after this wave of hacking of Twitter accounts of Elon Musk, Uber, Apple, and plenty more, several sources reached out and I pinged various other people who sent screenshots showing a sort of panel inside Twitter, sort of like a tool for administrators in the social network. And what we learned is that this played an important part in the takeover of these accounts. Somehow these hackers gained access to this tool and used it to change the email address on a number of these high-profile accounts. And then that let them take over and tweet various scams about cryptocurrency or potentially go through user information, but we don't have evidence of that yet. But this tool that normal Twitter employees would use was leveraged by the hackers.
So you're saying this had to be somebody inside Twitter?
The tool is ordinarily used by Twitter employees, and they need this sort of capability to do normal customer support, user support, you know, changing emails and that sort of thing. Twitter says it doesn't know whether it was an employee who gave access or whether it was inadvertent, but the sources we spoke to said that they were able to get access to this panel and then leverage it.
In your piece, which, by the way, is available at Vice.com, you refer to OG accounts. What is that?
Yes, it's a very unusual term. An OG account is a Twitter handle or Instagram and various other social networks as well that only have one or two characters. So maybe you have the Twitter account at W or maybe at L. And of course, these accounts are going to be much rarer. So people put financial value on them. They will hack into these accounts. They will then sell them or buy them. And some people, obviously hackers, buy them for bragging rights. They can show to their friends that, hey, I have this very rare Twitter account. And it's something, not just a financial currency, but a reputational currency in the criminal world as well.
And as you mentioned, these are some very high-profile accounts. Joe Biden, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, Barack Obama, Uber, and Apple. What does it tell you about the vulnerability of these accounts and this social media platform?
So users should always do stuff like have a unique password and use two-factor authentication, which is adding another layer of security to your account. But what this breach shows is that these employee tools, which isn't just Twitter, tech companies everywhere use tools like this because they have to, but regardless, it shows that they can be leveraged if they're either compromised or a rogue employee or whoever does gain access to them. That is a common problem across social networks and tech companies in general. And of course, what differentiates companies is how they limit access to that tool, how maybe if you're changing something on account, maybe you have to get secondary approval from a manager or something like that. It just shows that these tools exist. They are a risk to users and companies need to find a way to deal with that.
So moving ahead, that seems to be the biggest lesson.
Absolutely. The biggest reminder from this entire episode is that, yes, the tech platforms you use can likely interact with your account in some way. Again, because they have to, but it can be leveraged for nefarious or malicious purposes. If listeners should learn or remember anything, it's that takeaway, that these tools can be abused. But to be fair, it is somewhat rare, but it can still happen.
Joseph Cox, he's a senior staff writer for Motherboard. Joining us on the phone, we thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow losing ground, dropping 135 points. The NASDAQ was off by 76, and the S&P losing nearly 11. The Biden campaign continues to roll out leading surrogates as part of its summer strategy. Today, former Democratic rival, potential running mate, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
So question number four. So I am also a millennial, if you don't know, and I want to ask you this question. What would you say to a lot of millennials like myself, young people who are on the fence of voting for Joe in November? What could you say to them?
Vote like your life depends on it.
One.
Because it does. Pick any issue you care about. I guarantee it is on the line in this election, and Joe Biden has a vision for how to make change. If it's dismantling systemic racism, Joe Biden has been clear that as president, he's going to strengthen America's commitment to justice and to reform our criminal justice system. If it's for student debt, Joe is in the fight to help cancel student loan debt. If you believe in science and think we need to take action on climate change, Joe has just put out a plan to do that. If you know the importance of appointing judges who are committed to justice, Joe Biden is committed to doing that. You know, for me, this is about having a president who understands what's important and he's in there and willing to fight for it.
Another virtual town hall meeting with Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts. Meanwhile, a new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll shows where voters stand in this campaign. 50% of registered voters in the survey strongly disapprove of the president. 52% say they are very uncomfortable about his candidacy. 51% are backing Joe Biden versus 40% for President Trump. That is an 11-point lead for the Biden campaign. However, the same survey giving the Democratic candidate a low favorability rating, 46% view Joe Biden negatively. All the numbers and the details at the NBC News website and at WSJ.com. Now, before the outbreak of COVID-19, this was the week the Democrats had originally scheduled to meet in Milwaukee for their party convention. It now, of course, is scheduled for mid-August. Meanwhile, the Republicans announcing they will scale back the GOP convention as coronavirus cases continue to rise in Florida. Ronna McDaniel is the chair of the Republican National Committee. She informed members of the decision in a letter blaming the pandemic for the changes. So, among other things, admittance to the convention in Jacksonville, Florida will be limited only to regular delegates for the first 3 days, amounting to a crowd size of about 2,500. When the president formally accepts the nomination on the event's final day in late August, delegates will be allowed to bring one guest and an alternate delegate, but the crowd will be capped at no more than 7,000. And there will be a mix of venues in Jacksonville for the convention week. White House reaction to all of this from Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany.
When the president made the initial decision to move the Republican National Convention from Charlotte to Florida, he said that it was because the North Carolina governor was in a shutdown mood and that he was playing politics because he didn't want to pack an indoor stadium to full capacity. He also said that the cost to North Carolinians would be, and I'm quoting the president now, all of the jobs and the economic development the convention would bring. So all of that money, all of that time, all of that cost to jobs and economic development to North Carolinians for the same result, right? Because they're shrinking the convention in Florida. What does the president have to say to North Carolinians?
The president loves the people of North Carolina. They're well aware of that. The president wanted to be able to hold his convention, which is why it was moved to Jacksonville. And for anything further, I'd refer you to the RNC.
That from the White House earlier today. Of course, C-SPAN does remain your source for live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the party conventions next month in Milwaukee and in Jacksonville, Florida. And finally, during this summer of political conventions, a keynote speech on this date in 1984. The venue, San Francisco, Democrats nominating Walter Mondale that year, and New York Governor Mario Cuomo with the keynote address.
10 days ago, President Reagan admitted that although some people in this country seem to be doing well nowadays, others were unhappy, even worried about themselves, their families, and their futures. The president said that he didn't understand that fear. He said, "Why, this country is a shining city on a hill." And the president is right. In many ways, we are a shining city on a hill. But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. A shining city is perhaps all the president sees from the portico of the White House and the veranda of his ranch, where everyone seems to be doing well. But there's another city. There's another part to the shining city. The part where some people can't pay their mortgages, and most young people can't afford one. Where students can't afford the education they need, and middle-class parents watch the dreams they hold for their children evaporate. In this part of the city, there are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it. Even worse, there are elderly people who tremble in the basements of the houses there. And there are people who sleep in the city's streets, in the gutter, where the glitter doesn't show. There are ghettos where thousands of young people without a job or an education give their lives away to drug dealers every day. There is despair, Mr. President, in the faces that you don't see, in the places that you don't visit, in your shining city. In fact, Mr. President, this is a nation.
On this date, July 16th, 1984, Governor Mario Cuomo, the father of the current governor, the Democrats, though, would go on to lose to President Reagan in a landslide that year. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's also available as a podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts, or check it out on our website at cspan.org. Thanks for joining us for this Thursday, July 16th. I'm Steve Scully in Washington. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal, live every day, with news and policy issues that impact you. Coming up Friday morning, National Consumers League Executive Director Sally Greenberg discusses consumer protection efforts amid a surge in coronavirus scams. And Middle Tennessee State University's president, Sidney McPhee, who recently participated in a White House event on reopening schools, talks about the challenges managing a college during the coronavirus pandemic. Watch C-SPAN's Washington Journal, live at 7 Eastern Friday morning. Join the discussion.